Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily and these days more than daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Jonathan Reynolds, the Shadow City Minister. So we are looking ahead to Labour conference. Jonathan, what can we expect? A general election seems imminent if your party eventually decides to go for it. Is this going to be used to pump up the base in preparation for that?
I think so, yes. So I think the big benefit still of party conferences are the attention you get and the chance you get to put your message across. And of course, whilst I think we'd all expect Brexit to play some kind of part in that in terms of what the grassroots of the party are saying, it's a chance for us to put forward the domestic agenda, which is the only basis, I think, on which Labour will compete in a general election. So that will be about public services, that will be about post-austerity, if we believe that the Conservative government is now itself committed to ending austerity, and some new announcements about how we think we can make a difference to people's lives. So it's a big opportunity, and hopefully it won't all be about Brexit. It will be a little bit about that domestic agenda too.
And James, on Brexit, we've had Jeremy Corbyn write a Guardian op-ed this week in which he appeared to lay out what he plans the position to be for Labour in a general election, which is to, if there is a Labour government, renegotiate a Brexit deal, a softer Brexit than currently is on the table, and then put it to a vote in a second referendum and remain on the table. Do you think there is going to be a move by pro-EU members to try and soften that position further to make it more explicitly remain?
There is an irony here, which is one of the big features of Corbynism is this belief to return conference to be in the policy-making body of the party, you know, revive debate on the conference floor and all of that. And he is now turning up at conference with a policy that I think it is fairly safe to say that most Labour members are not comfortable with. It is heavily ambiguous. It essentially says that Labour would seek to negotiate a new Brexit deal and then there would be a second referendum with Leave and Remain on the ballot paper. And Jeremy Corbyn isn't saying which side he would be campaigning on. And I think a lot of people think that Labour should be explicitly a Remain party. I suspect that the Lib Dem position of revoking Article 50, which, you know, whatever one may think of it in terms of, you know, democratic norms and all that, gives them clarity and makes them an unambiguously Remain party. I think a lot of people, especially in seats where people fear competition from the Lib Dems, would fear that Labour are going to go into an election where they're going to get trapped in the middle, where you'll have the Tories saying, we're leaving on what, October the 31st or whatever their new date is, come what may, the Lib Dems saying revoke Article 50, and Labour trying to steer a middle ground. I think it's very interesting what Jonathan was saying about trying to get back onto the domestic agenda. That is clearly the Labour leadership's aim here. You kind of quarantine the Brexit issue in the second referendum, basically say you don't need to vote on Brexit because you'll get another chance to do that in 6 months' time. Let's vote on domestic policy. I just don't know how effective that is in a country which is now so polarised on this question.
Jonathan, are you expecting to see members at conference try and change your party's position? Because at last year's Labour conference, I remember there was an effort. There was a long, it seemed, negotiation between members and those probably closer to Jeremy Corbyn who wanted to maintain some Brexit ambiguity. Do you think your members are going to be satisfied with what Jeremy Corbyn is proposing?
I think the first thing you've got to say is, to be fair to Jeremy, how he has behaved and led the party in the last year has been entirely consistent with what the conference decided last year. So I think it is fair to respect that and say he is someone who approaches conference in that way. In terms of, you know, where the party are and how they'll feel about this position. Look, I'm someone who has, and I've said this publicly, been quite sceptical about whether a second referendum was the way forward. I look at it now and I think the only way I can see this country having any sort of closure on this initial bit of Brexit, because Brexit is not an event, it's a very long process, it is by having some definitive vote on the terms, the explicit terms of a new deal. And I think some people will look, for instance, at the Liberal Democrat position and say, look, that might be some sort of short-term advantage, but how can you say you could unilaterally revoke Article 50? I mean, the logic of that is you'd be happy with the government unilaterally invoking Article 50. I mean, that is not a sensible position. I can see it's good short-term politics, but ultimately the Lib Dems aren't competing across the country. They're only competing in a certain number of seats. Labour conference is a big event because it has people there from all over the country, including Labour leave areas. And I think the position that has been set out, which has a sort of throwback to the Harold Wilson position in terms of, you know, allowing people from different parts of the argument in the party to have a different take on that, is a pretty sensible way forward.
And looking at the domestic agenda which you were talking about, we heard reports that Now that Boris Johnson is in number 10, there are figures around Jeremy Corbyn who feel even more of a need to have a more radical policy agenda, to have more clear blue water. There's a sense that the Conservatives perhaps move towards Labour's position with declaring the decades of austerity is over. Do you think that the Conservatives appear to be going for Labour voters with their current pitch? Because that's what's being widely read, that Boris Johnson wants to move to taking lots of Labour seats.
Well, you have to assume that's true, because they're clearly not going for voters in Scotland, and they're clearly not looking for anyone who voted Remain in the referendum. I mean, the first point to say is, I think there's a bit of a caricature in number 10 about what Northern voters are like, and I think they fail to appreciate the complexity of Northern constituencies. But you know, the government position at the minute is you can have much higher public spending, falling government debt, and a no-deal Brexit. I mean, that is just impossible as a proposition to put to the country. But there's still plenty of clear red or blue water between the two parties. I think even if you were to believe the government could deliver the spending round that was set out a few weeks ago, it's still goes nowhere near to kind of healing the divisions that have come about through the last 9 years of austerity. I mean, as a constituency MP, still every day you're faced with issues of service reductions, further cuts, particularly in local authorities and in fire and police services. So I think there's still quite a big difference. But yes, if the agenda has moved on past the justification for austerity, that's clearly a move towards Labour's territory.
I mean, one of the other interesting questions is the 2017 Labour manifesto was strikingly cautious. And I mean, the question is, how much more radical is the next Labour manifesto going to be? I mean, I think, for example, it's quite interesting that John McDonnell is saying that he wants to back this abolish Eton motion. You know, I mean, this is kind of classic stuff that you can imagine that previous Labour leadership sort of said, look, no need to scare the horses, let's leave that well alone. Instead, they seem to be leaning into this. The positive noises they're making about a four-day week, for example, is another thing which you would think that if you were trying to run a kind of Ming Vars electoral strategy, you would back away from. I think this is going to be one of the big questions, which is that 2017 manifesto was surprisingly mainstream social democratic, I think, to people in all wings of the Labour Party. The question in 2019 is, or 2020, whenever this election actually finally ends up taking place, is the manifesto going to be more distinctly Corbynite? Is it going to mark a significant shift towards the economic left or not?
And at last year's Labour conference, it seemed the themes were renewal. And we had the party political broadcast around the time of Our Town. And it seemed there was a big push, which was trying to say lots of the divisions, perhaps, which led to the Brexit vote, so areas that felt left behind, Labour was aiming to solve not perhaps having an over-focus on its Brexit policy, but for addressing it on domestic agenda. Do you think it's the same message, or are we going to get a different flavour this time around?
I think that's what is at the heart of it. I mean, I do a lot of meetings in the city, obviously the shadow city minister, and I always say to people who are, you know, they're worried about the political instability in the UK, you've got to look at the sources of that. You've got to look at where this has come from, the same way you have to look at why Trump is the president of the USA, or how Macron broke the party system in France. There are underlying issues, particularly about the stagnation in wages over the last decade and so forth, not just about the austerity agenda, but how the economy has functioned and where the returns of economic growth have gone to. And that is at the heart of addressing not just what people want to see after Brexit is initially dealt with, but, you know, a much bigger sense of dissatisfaction with how the country is run. And I think the danger would be if governments were not competing to address those needs. That's where the real source of instability would come from.
As Shadow City Minister, you're probably in a good position to answer this question, Jonathan, which is there have been reports that if you speak to various financiers, the fear in the city, if neither is one that they delight in, perhaps between no deal and a Jeremy Corbyn government, but push came to shove, Jeremy Corbyn government is seen as more damaging than no deal. Is that something you have picked up? I presume you're going to tell me no, but
I'm definitely going to tell you no. I mean, I think if you look at the sort of how the debate on Brexit has gone, not just what it means, I mean, there is a complete lack of recognition from the government in all of their negotiations that they've done, that the UK economy is a services-based economy, fundamentally. And I think if you think about not just what that means in terms of the loss of market access to the European Union, but especially things like the loss of access to talent through the end of freedom of movement, there is a huge amount of anger in places like the city, not just at what Brexit means, but at the attitude from Conservatives, who they may have seen as natural allies in some ways, towards the whole sector. And of course, if you look at who works in the city, these are people with high levels of education, they are living in the main in urban areas, in cities, they are earning, you know, fairly decent salaries. Those kinds of constituencies right now are represented by the Labour Party. So there's quite a bit of support there for us.
Do you think the government's Brexit policy, putting no deal on the table then, from your perspective, has made these figures more receptive to your party?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I mean, I think a no-deal Brexit is such a destructive proposition, not just because of the short-term disruption, but really because you're then losing any of the good faith you might need to negotiate the long-term position, which most people would find fairly favourable. That there is no doubt it is. You know, it rings hollow when Conservative politicians say Labour's too much of a risk if they are even willing to contemplate getting to that no deal Brexit position.
At the risk of teaching one's grandmother to suck eggs, I mean, I think that there are different views in the city on the Brexit question. Obviously, if you are an American bank that uses London as your gateway to Europe, you are much more concerned about the loss of passporting than if you are a global bank that is based in London, or if you are a British bank that is worried about, you know, for example, you know, one of the big threats to the city is this deregulatory, I mean, obviously Elizabeth Warren would reverse this, but the kind of Trump deregulatory twist in the US, that I think is, to some banks, a bigger concern. And that obviously would make you more concerned about a Corbyn government than a no-deal Brexit. So I think there are different interests in the city that have different views. I think they're not particularly delighted about Labour's policy of banning bonuses. And
there is no Labour policy on that. John was just quite rightly talking about the levels of compensation in a society where inequality is a big political issue, rightly
up
so.
Up for discussion still.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
No, so I think Donovan's obviously right, which is that the lock of the Tory city is, I think, less of an issue, less of a fact than it was. I think there is probably now much more of a Lib Dem city than anyone expected there to be. I mean, if you want to find out who is loving the revoke policy, I suggest that we could get in a taxi from here and it would take us about 15 minutes and we'd find a lot of people who think this is very sensible. So I think there are different views there. I think there is a question, which is this, which is, I think the bigger issue about Brexit is, what economic model does the UK end up pursuing after Brexit? And I think if you look at the new stumbling blocks to a deal, it's not going to be Singapore on Thames. I mean that is an exaggeration. But I think it is quite clear when you look at what the government now wish to get away from in terms of level playing field requirements and all that, it's quite clear that the UK's, if Boris Johnson had his druthers, that the UK would pursue a different economic model to the European one. But it would drift a bit further into the Atlantic. That this would be, and I think that is something that is going to be a massive issue of political debate in this country, which is, you know, do we wish to change the economic model, which is Labour are saying, let's change the economic model to become more European, essentially. You know, this is, you know, and Corbynism is an attempt to go kind of, if Jeremy Corbyn became Prime Minister, I think by the end of, and his premiership succeeded, in inverted commas, in his own terms, the UK would be a less free marketplace than Germany or France by the end of it. While as, if Boris Johnson succeeded and the UK left the EU, I think the UK would be considerably more free market than anywhere in Europe by the end of his term. And I think that is one of the big issues at the next general election is going to be, you know, which of those forks in the road does the country want to take?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. But also, not just for the next election, but actually much longer than that. I mean, when you look from the perspective of a Labour MP on Conservative Euroscepticism, it seems to me, I don't know if this is fair or not, that it is underpinned by a sense that somehow the European Union institutionally favours a kind of left of centre, socially democratic set of economic institutions. I think that is erroneous in their analysis, but that seems to be it. So when we have the conversation, you know, in Parliament about there won't be any reduction in workers' rights, there won't be any reduction in product standards or environmental standards, in a sense, I think most Labour MPs ask, then why do you want to do it? Because surely it's to unwind that sense of a left-of-centre institutional framework that underpins that. And I think you look at that and you think that is why, you know, Brexit is a process, not an event, and it will go on for years.
I think there is obviously some truth to that. I mean, it is worth remembering that when Margaret Thatcher, for example, supported Britain join the European Economic Community, the idea was that giving up a certain amount of sovereignty was a worthwhile hedge against Benism. And I think that, you know, Tory attitudes to Europe undoubtedly changed when, you know, Jacques Delors turned up at the TUC and gave his speech. I mean, that made people on the right think about it differently. I think it's a tiny bit more nuanced than what Jonathan was saying. I think the kind of question is, a Tory government would want to move away from the kind of essentially the European precautionary principle. I think the argument is we're about to move into an era with AI and technology in general, where how open are you to innovation? How open are you? How prepared are you to take risks in the interest of things like, you know, driverless cars and all that stuff, the EU will take a very, very cautious attitude to it. And I think that will make it a global laggard in terms of innovation. It's going to lag behind Asia and the US, which will have much more open attitudes to this stuff. And so I think there is a question about where the UK wishes to position itself. And I think in an era of massive technological disruption and change, being in a very cautious bloc that will tend to move at the pace of the slowest member state, and which has various, on scientific stuff, various cultural hang-ups, and generally a more negative attitude to innovation, is that a sensible strategy for the UK or not?
Yeah, I mean, when you think of things like, you know, genetically modified crops, I think that is a fair assessment. I think where that will run into much tougher ground, having, you know, been a member of the Business Select Committee during the TTIP negotiations and seeing correspondence from constituents on things like food standards and, you know, the comparative position of the US to the UK, the British public would accept that reduction, that taking away of the precautionary principle. I'd be really surprised if the public would move in that direction at the same pace, because I think the European position, the UK position as is now, is broadly where they're at.
And moving to the prospect of a potential Brexit deal, there's some talk that Boris Johnson could try and pass a Brexit deal around the time of the EU Council summit, before that 31st of October deadline. And there's also suggestions among some of your colleagues that there could be up to 40 Labour MPs who would vote for that deal. Do you think that number rings true?
Not really, because I think, I mean, the last time the withdrawal agreement was put, the third time it was defeated, I think the number briefed by the government was 50, so it seems broadly still
Labour colleagues
in that territory. I think there is clearly the possibility of, as I look at it now, some sort of deal where the backstop is moved to Northern Ireland only and a few other things come forward. The bottom line is that Theresa May deal, however you repackage it, it is not a very good one. It doesn't deliver the, in any sense, that the basic national negotiating objectives the UK should have, which is, you know, trying to keep the friction at the border in goods as low as possible, and giving you some framework where you might continue some degree of market access for services. So it might well be that people look at it and say, look, compared to the cliff edge of no deal, I'm willing to look at that. But I don't think people should assume that necessarily the country's in a position to back that. Because don't forget, when those votes were put to Parliament, whether your seat was Leave or Remain, both sides of the argument didn't like the deal. And that was the fundamental error of the Theresa May deal. So we shall see. Frankly, when I talk to Conservative MPs, they themselves at the minute don't think a deal is going to come forward.
On a deal, I chuck two things out there which might get more Labour MPs to vote for it. One is, I think, you know, Number 10 and the EU are discussing something that Theresa May discussed with them as well, which is, you know, making clear that if a deal was reached at the council, which is odds against, I'm not saying there's kind of more than 50% chance of a deal, but if one was reached, that the condition of that deal would be that there'd be no further extension offered. So essentially, this is deal or no deal. Which one do you want to take? I think that would probably push a few more MPs into the division lobby. The other thing that might push more MPs into the division lobby, frankly, is the deselections that people think are coming in the Labour Party. If you think you're done, if you think your career's over, that there is an inclination in saying, well, my last act will be in the national interest to avoid the disruption of a no-deal Brexit. I'll vote for this deal, get this done, move on. I think that's another factor here, which is if you think your career is... I mean, if you look at the Tory rebels, it's clear that when people think their political careers are coming to an end in their party, they're more inclined to rebel against the whip.
And it's definitely true of the Tory rebels, though we should say, I mean, most of Labour's re-selections are about to be concluded, and many colleagues have gone through absolutely fine, and I, you know, think there's been a few people triggered, but not very many. Nothing like the scale that people thought it would have.
And finally, you're going to be spending the next few days in Brighton, Jonathan. So I just wondered, on top of the Labour conference, you have the World Transformed Momentum's outfit. Are you going to be down at that one?
When you're a front bencher, particularly a Shadow Treasury Minister, it's pretty busy, and there's a lot of things to get to.
I've seen John McDonnell make an appearance there before.
Oh, I'm sure John will be booked in to do it. I don't spend much time at the World Transformed, but what I've seen of it, it is actually, you know, quite intellectually vibrant. It is perhaps surprising to what people think it might have been. I mean, some of the things that I'm interested in, things like electoral reform, and I think there's quite fundamental democratic reform required. It's quite a vibrant audience for that, actually. So I genuinely see it as a welcome addition to conference.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, James.